I asked the president about his ranch and whether he was able to get out there often. Reagan brightened at the mention of the subject and spoke for about 15 minutes about how he'd had to give up his old ranch when he was elected governor of California because the taxes on it were half of his salary. Since then, he'd found new property in a mountainous area that he referred to as goat country. Mrs. Reagan said it was full of trees and pastures, terrific for riding. I have remained a close friend of Nancy Reagan. She was a dedicated ally in lining up support when we both fought in vain during George W. Bush's administration to restore funding for embryonic stem cell research. Nancy, of course, was motivated partly by her husband's tragic affliction with Alzheimer's disease. She said, "Give me the names of people you want me to call." I gave her the names, and she called every one of them. She called back and said, "Give me some more names." On January 21, 1981, Joan and I finally accepted the inevitable and divorced. It was amicable, and we agreed to share the duties of raising the children. Joan moved into the apartment in Boston. I maintained residence in the McLean house. I faced a re-election bid for the Senate in 1982, and while I did not feel that my seat was in serious trouble, I always took elections seriously. I was mindful that there might be political fallout from my run, and loss, for the nomination in 1980, and that outstanding senators and good friends, John Culver, Birch Bayh, and Frank Church, had just lost their re-elections when Reagan swept into victory. It was also the first time I would be running as an unmarried man. My team produced a number of TV ads for the 1982 election. I trusted the voters of Massachusetts to respond to messages of hope, frankness, and humanity. One ad featured Luella Hennessy Donovan, the beloved nurse and governess from my childhood, who described how I had slept in a chair beside Teddy's hospital bed while he was recuperating from his leg amputation. Another featured Frank Manning, an 83-year-old advocate for senior citizens, who avowed, "He's not a plaster saint. He's not without his faults. But we wouldn't want a plaster saint. We want an average human being who has feelings and likes people and who is interested in their welfare." Even these mild excursions into persuasion caused me some personal discomfort. With them, and also with the tireless organizing of a first-time campaign manager named Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, I won my fourth re-election to the Senate that year, defeating the Republican businessman Ray Shamey with 60% of the vote. In the waning months of 1983, I delivered two speeches that have remained dear to me. The circumstances and the audiences for the talks were about as divergent as it was possible to get. The first was to an audience of students and faculty at a famous evangelical college in Virginia. The second was to a far smaller gathering of family and friends at a memorial mass in Washington. And yet on a deeper level, they shared a great deal. What unified the two talks was the presence in them of my late brother, John F. Kennedy. I had not eulogized Jack on any of the anniversaries since his death on November 22, 1963, though I quoted him and invoked his vision in nearly every commemorative speech I gave. For several years, the risk of being overcome with emotion dissuaded me. Then, as I began to seriously be mentioned as a presidential candidate, and in fact moved actively into that arena, I held back out of concern that any tribute I paid my brother be misconstrued as a play for voters' sympathies. But in 1983, I was not an active candidate. Moreover, the escalating demolition by the Reagan administration of my brother's accomplishments and its tacit repudiation of Jack's historic vision compelled me to remind Americans of the principles Jack had stood for and how deeply imperiled those principles were. I sifted through my mail folder on a late summer day in 1983 and found myself staring, with great amusement, at an envelope with an instantly familiar return address. I opened it and withdrew a promotional invitation designed to look like a passport. It was a membership card to the Liberty Baptist College in Lynchburg, Virginia, home base of the Reverend Jerry Falwell, who routinely used me as a whipping boy for his homilies on godless liberalism and immorality. The pitch was sweetened with an invitation for me to join up and help fight ultra-liberals such as Ted Kennedy. The mailing had reached me via a computer error so sublimely improbable that as a practicing Christian, I could hardly help wondering whether it was divinely inspired. I passed it along to a reporter friend who wrote a whimsical item about it. The item came to the attention of Cal Thomas, then a vice president of Falwell's Moral Majority. Thomas wrote me an equally whimsical invitation to come and visit the campus sometime. I wrote him back, cordially, but not at all whimsically, that I'd be delighted to come, and that I wanted to speak as well. Thomas forwarded my suggestion to Falwell. Thus it was that on the evening of October 3, 1983, I stood behind a microphone in the auditorium of Liberty Baptist College and made ready to speak to 5,000 expectant young evangelicals and their teachers. Falwell himself looked on with a tightly composed smile of a genial host. It was easy to imagine that a fractious hour lay ahead. Boos, hisses, people filing out of the hall, any of this would have played into popular stereotype. But as I looked into the young faces, I saw no hatred, no defiance. Only the opaque but attentive stares of intelligent young people that are well known to any college professor at the outset of a lecture. I began with a gentle joke. They seem to think that it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle than for a Kennedy to come to the campus of Liberty Baptist College. This received a gratifying ripple of laughter. I built on it. In honor of our meeting, I have asked Dr. Falwell, as your chancellor, to permit all the students an extra hour next Saturday night before curfew. And in return, I have promised to watch the old-time gospel hour next Sunday morning. More laughter. And I sensed some relaxation in the auditorium, certainly in myself. I moved ahead into the heart of my message. I'd come, I told them, to discuss my beliefs about faith and country, tolerance and truth in America. I knew we had certain disagreements, but I hoped that tonight and in the years ahead, we would always respect the right of others to differ and never lose sight of our own fallibility, that we would view ourselves with a sense of perspective and a sense of humor. I mentioned the bane of intolerance, citing Dr. Falwell himself as a victim of it for advocating the ecumenical church. Then I moved quickly to the more pressing question of whether and how religion should influence government. A generation ago, a presidential candidate had to prove his independence of undue religious influence in public life, and he had to do so partly at the insistence of evangelical Protestants. John Kennedy said at that time, "I believe in an America where there is no religious bloc voting of any kind." I contrasted Jack's stance with that of one of the students' idols. Only 20 years later, another candidate was appealing to an evangelical meeting as a religious bloc. Ronald Reagan said to 15,000 evangelicals at the Round Table in Dallas, "I know that you can't endorse me. I want you to know I endorse you and what you are doing." To many, I said, that pledge was a sign of a dangerous breakdown in the separation of church and state. Our challenge was to recall the origin of the principle, to define its purpose, and refine its application to the politics of the present. I recounted our nation's long history of religious intolerance. In colonial Maryland, Catholics paid a double land tax, and in Pennsylvania, they had to list their names on a public roll, an ominous precursor of the first Nazi laws against the Jews. The real transgression occurs when religion wants government to tell citizens how to live uniquely personal parts of their lives. In cases such as prohibition and abortion, the proper role of religion is to appeal to the conscience of the individual, not the coercive power of the state. But there are other questions which are inherently public in nature, which we must decide together as a nation, and where religion and religious values can and should speak to our common conscience. The issue of nuclear war is a compelling example. To take a stand, when a question is both properly public and truly moral, is to stand in a long and honored tradition. I cited the evangelists of the 1800s, who were in the forefront of the abolitionist movement. The Reverend William Sloan Coffin, who challenged the morality of the war in Vietnam. Pope John XXIII, who renewed the gospel's call to social justice. And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was the greatest prophet of this century, awakened our nation and its conscience to the evil of racial segregation. I was gratified to note that the students and faculty had begun interrupting my speech, not with jeers, but with applause. The end of my speech was approaching, and I drew once again upon the words of Jack. I cited a talk he had given in November 1963 to the Protestant Council of New York City to reaffirm what he regarded as some fundamental truths. "On that occasion," John Kennedy said, "the family of man is not limited to a single race or religion, to a single city or country. The family of man is nearly 3 billion strong. Most of its members are not white, and most of them are not Christian." And as President Kennedy reflected on that reality, he restated an ideal for which he had lived his life, that the members of this family should be at peace with one another. "That ideal," I concluded, "shines across all the generations of our history. As the Apostle Paul wrote long ago in Romans, 'If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men.'" I believe it is possible. As fellow citizens, let us live peaceably with each other. As fellow human beings, let us strive to live peaceably with men and women everywhere. Let that be our purpose and our prayer, yours and mine, for ourselves, for our country, and for all the world. In the months and years that followed, Jerry Falwell's public references to me softened. For what that said about living peaceably with each other, I've always felt grateful. The second meaningful talk of that autumn, my 20th anniversary eulogy of Jack, came in Washington after I had spent a quiet evening at the Cape House with my mother and Jackie. We flew together to Washington and were driven to Holy Trinity, where my brother had worshipped on the morning of his inauguration. President and Mrs. Reagan sat in the front pew at the Mass. I began with some memories of Jack from my childhood. Walking along the beach at home, he said to me when I was very young, "On a clear day, you can see all the way to Ireland." I recalled the gentle, natural ways in which he would look after Rosemary, always including her in the sailing expeditions with the rest of us. "Compassion was at the center of his soul," I said, "but he never wore it on his sleeve." I evoked his wit, which I said marks our love for him, with laughter. I recalled how after he talked Bobby into accepting the Attorney General post, he made a simple request: "Please, Bobby, just comb your hair." I summed up, as succinctly as I could, the list of his great achievements: championing the American landing on the moon, building the political foundations of the Civil Rights Act, standing firm in Berlin and during the Cuban Missile Crisis, creating the Alliance for Progress and the Peace Corps, bringing us, in his last months, the Test Ban Treaty and the beginning of an end to the Cold War. Let me acknowledge here that a loyal and loving brother cannot provide a dispassionate view of John Kennedy's presidency. Much has been written about his personal life. A lot of it is bullshit. All of it is beyond the scope of my direct experience. There were conversational boundaries in our family, and we respected them. For example, I had no idea of how serious Jack's health problems were while he was alive. It would never have occurred to us to discuss such private things with each other. Historians will come to their own judgments about President Kennedy. Here is how I choose to remember him. He was an heir to wealth, who felt the anguish of the poor. He was an orator of excellence, who spoke for the voiceless. He was a son of Harvard, who reached out to the sons and daughters of Appalachia. He was a man of special grace, who had a special care for the retarded and handicapped. He was a hero of war, who fought hardest for peace. He said and proved in word and deed that one man can make a difference. I did not want to see a second Reagan administration, yet I could find no Democratic figure on the horizon who convinced me that he or she was capable of unseating the force of nature who was our president. And so in 1982, I asked my aide Larry Horowitz to explore the feasibility of another run. My explorations did not last long. The decisive forces were my three children. Actually, they were no longer children now, but young adults. Kara was 22, Teddy not quite 21, and Patrick 15. And yet, of course, they were still my children. Over the late summer and early autumn of 1982, I sounded them out in several searching conversations about their feelings on another presidential campaign. I will never forget this series of talks with them. What they had to say made all the difference. Our first occurred as we sailed to Nantucket from Hyannisport on September 26th, Teddy's 21st birthday. The water was quiet and peaceful, and the sun shone on their faces. Teddy spoke up first. He had reservations, he admitted. He felt that in my 1980 run I had stood for and expressed all the things I believed in, and that now my place was in the Senate. Then he got to the heart of the matter. Another campaign would put the family through a great deal of turmoil. He did not say so specifically, but I sensed that the turmoil would center on my safety. "Of course not," he said, as Kara and Patrick nodded. "If I made the decision to run, all of them would support me." But did it really make sense? We all kept on probing the topic in a relaxed way for more than an hour, as the boat cruised gently toward Nantucket. Kara was somewhat more open-minded to the prospect than Teddy, but Patrick agreed rather strongly with his brother. I thanked all of them at the end and asked them to give it some more thought. I learned a good deal more about the depth of Patrick's feelings when the two of us went to the Cape House by ourselves for one of those delicious late fall weekends, of the kind that Bobby and I spent together so many years ago, walking on the beach and building campfires and sleeping in the chilly garage. My son and I enjoyed a good meal and some talk about what was happening at his school, and then it was late, and I decided to turn in. I said goodnight to Patrick and went to my father's room to sleep. I was dozing off when I became aware of a presence in the room. Patrick had come in silently, and when he knew I'd seen him, he sat on a chair, but remained quiet. It was easy to see that he was troubled. "Are you concerned about the future?" I asked him. He nodded and murmured that he was. "He really did not want me to run," he said, and his voice grew husky. "If I were elected president," he said, "I would not have as much time to spend with him as he wanted. As it was, he didn't see enough of me. It would create an absence in his life that would be hard to fill. He became rather teary-eyed, very sweet about it, and then went to bed. On the last week of my Senate re-election campaign, Patrick and I were driving over from Hyannis to Oyster Harbor. I asked him whether he had changed his mind at all. He said he had not. The next time we broached the subject was on November 2nd, the night of my Senate re-election. I told my children honestly that I was giving serious consideration to the run, and I wanted to have one more intense conversation with them about it, perhaps on Thanksgiving weekend, when we would all be together for a few days. I could tell by their faces this time that each was deeply troubled by the prospect, more troubled than I had realized. On that weekend, I asked Larry Horowitz to come to the Cape and brief the children and other family members as to where we stood politically. Over 2.5 hours at Jackie's house, Larry reviewed the various polling data and how it reflected the positive view that people had of me after watching those TV spots in focus group sessions in New Hampshire. This was an encouraging and even rather significant trend, given that at the same time, Reagan's poll numbers were rising while those of his likely challenger, Walter Mondale, were slipping down. The children inferred from this session that my aides and I were gearing up seriously to make a run, and I must say that they were right. Everyone in the room could see the likelihood of my gaining the nomination, and also that the election campaign would be hard-fought and probably be decided by the television debates. Yet the Reagan administration was showing some signs of missteps. They've been talking lately about taxing unemployment insurance, which would outrage many of their moderate supporters. I really felt that this was the race for me. All of the other times I had taken a pass on running were because it wasn't my time. Those earlier races wouldn't have been about me. They would have been about my being a surrogate for my brothers. And in 1980, as much as I had wanted to win, I felt almost forced into the decision by what I saw as Carter's dragging down of the country and the party. But 1984 would be my race on my terms, and I thought I had a good chance. I did not ask for reactions from the family at that meeting. My nephew Joe wished me luck, but went on to say that from what he'd heard, the family anticipated a great deal of anguish and anxiety, and that I should give that prospect very serious consideration. My sister Pat seemed to be leaning toward a run. Jean was against it. Steve Smith thought it would be an extremely difficult battle. The Sunday after Thanksgiving, my children and I went to the Squaw Island house. I told them how much I respected their grasp of the political realities of a run and of what a campaign would entail. Then I asked them whether they'd formed a final judgment. Once again, Teddy was the spokesman. He told me that he and Patrick had been having many serious discussions between themselves, and that they both felt strongly that I should not run. I would continue to be a force in the Democratic Party, he pointed out, and in the Senate. People would continue to pay attention to my views. He, Patrick, and Kara were not asking me to step out of public life, he stressed. But given the existing turmoil resulting from Jones and my divorce, and the change and uncertainty for all of them that had entailed, a run for the presidency might amount to unbearable strain. I looked at Patrick, who was obviously uncomfortable. He did not want the brunt of my decision placed upon his shoulders. He assured me that he would support any decision that I made. Should the decision be to go, he said he was quite prepared for it. But he just thought the family would be happier if I didn't make that decision to go. There was plenty of time in the future. I shifted my gaze to Kara. She agreed totally with Patrick. If I felt there was a moral imperative to run, they were prepared to sign on and be part of the team. But quite clearly, their choice and recommendation were not to go forward with the campaign. The meeting lasted about 2 hours, and by the end of it, as far as I was concerned, the decision had been made. If the children felt that strongly about my not running, then I would not run. They all came back to the big house with me, and we had dinner with my mother. I could clearly detect the relief in their minds and in their attitudes and their general dispositions. A couple of days later, I announced that I would not be a candidate for the presidency in 1984. After the press conference, I had a chance for quiet moments with each of the children and asked whether they thought they made the right decision. The response was so uniform, so complete, so overwhelming. It was the right decision. But it was 15-year-old Patrick who really brought it home for me. When Patrick and I were sitting together after the announcement, just the two of us, I looked at his face and his smile. He was so happy and obviously so enormously relieved. If I ever harbored any second thoughts about the decision, they vanished at that moment. I braced for new battles on even more hostile terrain when Reagan, at 73, won re-election in November 1984. The oldest elected president in American history rolled up the highest electoral vote in American history, 525-13 against Walter Mondale. Reagan had made a laudable choice in his first high court appointment in 1981. Honoring a campaign promise to nominate a qualified woman, he chose the Arizona Republican Sandra Day O'Connor, who replaced the retiring Potter Stewart. She did not become the predictably conservative vote that the Republican right might have hoped. She became famous for avoiding predictability, as the court's leading swing vote on politically charged cases, including upholding Roe v. Wade. Reagan's next high court appointment was to nominate William Rehnquist to be elevated from Associate Justice of the Supreme Court to Chief Justice of the United States. As an Associate Justice, Rehnquist had staked out a position on the court's far right and held it unwaveringly. I was opposed to his elevation to Chief Justice for the same reasons that I had opposed his nomination to the court in the first place, but I understood that the odds were strongly in favor of his confirmation. In the Judiciary Committee on July 29, 1986, I bore in strongly on Rehnquist's string of lone dissents as an Associate Justice. The framers of the Constitution envisioned a major role for the Senate in the appointment of judges, I declared. It is an historical nonsense to suggest that all the Senate has to do is check the nominee's IQ, make sure he has a law degree and no arrests, and rubber-stamp the president's choice. Along with Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio, I resurrected the two damaging pieces of evidence that Rehnquist had shown racial bias in his past. These were the charges that he had harassed black voters at the polls in Arizona in the 1950s and 60s, and the memo he'd written in 1971 maintaining that separate but equal should be reaffirmed. None of it mattered. Rehnquist sailed past the committee by a vote of 13-5, and he was confirmed by a vote of 65-33. Still, he received the most no votes ever cast against a Chief Justice nominee up to that time. Lewis Powell announced his retirement that same year. Powell was a true moderate on the bench and was often a swing vote, sometimes bridging differences between his more liberal and conservative colleagues. I had a strong sense that Reagan's nominee to replace Powell would not share his qualities of moderation. By the time Powell resigned on June 26, 1987, I had prepared myself to seize the initiative against the likely replacement nominee, Robert Bork. I had my eye on Bork since he fired Archibald Cox during Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre. I'd watched him closely and believed his legal theories were totally out of the mainstream. And he had a written record that set forth his extreme views for all the country to see. On July 1st, within 45 minutes of Reagan's announcement that Bork was in fact his nominee, I arose on the Senate floor and spoke out against Bork and his vision of America. I knew my speech was red hot even before I delivered it. I wanted it that way, immediate and fiery, because I wanted to frame the debate. I knew I was making myself a target by being so heated in my rhetoric, but it was a price I was willing to pay to keep this man off the court. In what came to be known as the Robert Bork's America speech, I urged Bork's rejection on several grounds. That he stood for an extremist view of the Constitution and the role of the Supreme Court. That he deposed the Public Accommodation Civil Rights Act, as well as the Supreme Court's one-man, one-vote ruling in 1964. That he saw the First Amendment as protecting only political speech and not literature or works of art or scientific expression. Robert Bork's America, I continued, is a land in which women would be forced into back-alley abortions. Blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters. Rogue police could break down citizens' doors in midnight raids. School children could not be taught about evolution. Writers and artists could be censored at the whim of government. And the doors of the federal courts would be shut on the fingers of millions of citizens for whom the judiciary is and is often the only protector of the individual rights that are at the heart of our democracy. I closed with a declaration that President Reagan should not be able to reach into the muck of Watergate and impose his reactionary vision of the Constitution on the Supreme Court and on the next generation of Americans. No justice would be better than this injustice. On summer weekends, I turned the house at Hyannisport into a command center, from where I invited or telephoned dozens of legal scholars, my fellow senators, advocates for African Americans and women, anyone I could locate who had an informed opinion as to issues at stake. I listened, debated, researched, synthesized, and finally began to draft the input into an argument. An early headcount by the Democratic whip Alan Cranston in mid-July showed a tilt toward Bork's chances for confirmation. By mid-August, the mobilization against him was accelerating. I helped it along by sending out briefing books on the nominee's positions to senators and a personal letter to 6,200 black elected officials across America alerting them to Bork's threat to civil rights. I telephoned many leaders of national civil rights organizations. I urged Archibald Cox himself to speak out on his views of the Saturday night massacre. The hearings began on September 15th, led by Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joe Biden. Fortified by preparation that was even more exhaustive than usual, I'd held mock hearing sessions with such constitutional experts as Lawrence Tribe of the Harvard Law School. I was able to get the nominee to admit that at one time he saw no right of privacy in the Constitution, didn't think the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment applied to women, believed the states had the right to levy poll taxes, and that he'd once characterized the 1964 civil rights law requiring proprietors to serve African Americans in public places as a principle of unsurpassed ugliness. These words were from his own testimony. The second 2 days were more of the same. On September 18th, in fact, I played a tape that annihilated Bork's claim that as a justice he would give full weight to judicial precedent. The tape captured him telling a college audience in 1985, "I don't feel that in the field of constitutional law, precedent is all that important. I think the importance is what the framers were driving at." It was an onslaught of fact and damaging admission, and it worked dramatically. By late September, opinion polls were showing a 10% shift against Bork as a result of the hearings. On October 1st, 5 previously uncommitted Southern Democrats and the then Republican from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter, announced their opposition to Bork. The full Judiciary Committee voted 9-5 against recommending him 5 days later, and on October 23rd, his nomination was rejected by a vote of 58-42, with 17 Republicans in the majority, the largest margin of defeat in history for a Supreme Court nominee. My final summation of Ronald Reagan is complicated. I recognize that millions of people will always remember him as a great president. It is too early to really know what history's verdict will be. I believe that he failed to meet the ultimate criteria of greatness. His economic theories were certainly debatable, to say the least. But more than that was his complacency and even insensitivity regarding civil rights. He opposed the principles of the Voting Rights Act, for example, which he described during his campaign as humiliating to the South, rather than focusing his comments on the practices that led to the need for such a law as humiliating to African Americans. I feel that Ronald Reagan led the country in the wrong direction, sensing and playing to its worst impulses at a moment in history that called desperately for a higher vision. The term government was degraded into a working synonym for ineptitude or even hostile entity. Nearly all the important imprints of his presidency bore features that rebuked or rolled back the hard-earned progress of African Americans dating to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. His choice of the Neshoba County Fair near Philadelphia, Mississippi, as the site for his first speech after being nominated, was appalling. Philadelphia was the site of one of the most heinous racial crimes of the 20th century, the murder of three young civil rights workers by white supremacists in 1964. He slashed education and social programs that protected the dispossessed, while scolding the phantom welfare queens who used their food stamps to buy steak and whiskey. He denounced the imprisoned Nelson Mandela as a terrorist and supported the apartheid government of South Africa. He vetoed a bill that would have authorized sanctions against that country's racist de Klerk regime. Congress overrode the veto. And yet I cannot help affirming that Ronald Reagan deserves his special niche in the minds of the American people. As an optimist myself, I admire optimists. He made people feel upbeat about the country, a welcome mood shift after the Carter era. As the nation moved rightward, many pundits suggested that, and many politicians acted as though we were entering a sweeping and permanent new political climate. I never agreed with that view, harvested mainly from opinion polls and focus groups, nor the repositioning that it spawned. I recognized that some sort of shift was inevitable. My brother Jack used to say that ours was basically a conservative country, but that people wanted progress. So if you talked conservative and voted liberal, you'd win every time. I believe there's a lot to that bit of political wisdom. While I haven't mastered the art of talking conservative, experience has convinced me that genuine, principled leadership can persuade our people that their enlightened self-interest lies to the left. The historic gains of the New Deal, the New Frontier, and the Great Society attest to that. I maintained my conviction that the working-class majority forged by Roosevelt remained our best hope for justice and progress. Chapter 20. The Family Business, 1988 to 1990. As 1988 dawned and the Reagan administration entered its final year, I looked forward to a fascinating fall election season. Reagan's vice president, George H.W. Bush, was viewed as an early favorite in the crowded Republican primaries that also featured Congressman Jack Kemp of New York, Senator Bob Dole of Kansas, and former cabinet members Alexander Haig and Donald Rumsfeld. The Democratic primary field crackled with talent. Congressman Dick Gephardt of Missouri, Senator Paul Simon and the Reverend Jesse Jackson of Illinois, Governor Michael Dukakis of Massachusetts, Senators Al Gore of Tennessee and Joe Biden of Delaware, former Senator Gary Hart of Colorado, and former Governor Bruce Babbitt of Arizona. Hopes ran high among Democrats that one of these men would lead the nation past 8 years of Reaganomics that had tripled the national debt from $900 billion when he took office to more than $2.8 trillion at the end of his term. I faced a re-election test of my own that year. But even as I prepared for it with the diligence that any campaign for the Senate deserves, my highest hopes were keyed to a race that involved neither the presidency nor the Congress, but a relatively obscure state-level district in Rhode Island and a fellow just barely old enough to vote, let alone stand for office. In April, my son Patrick had decided to toss his hat into the political ring. He was a sophomore at Providence College that spring. He would not turn 21 until July. Yet his call to politics was serious and mature, and his passion for it ran deep. And that passion was his own. Patrick was not a carbon copy of me in his views or in his style, though our beliefs are similar on most issues. I've never tried to tell him how to think. Nor has he needed me to. Patrick lived politics his whole young life. His friendly face beneath his shock of red hair instantly draws people to him. Patrick returns the warmth. Then, too, he had and maintains a zest for campaigning, despite the fact that he had grown up reserved and rather shy. He quickly learned to love getting out there. He knew that people liked to see their representatives, needed to see them out there, working hard. Patrick gave his political impulses a test run in early March, when he ran for and was elected a Rhode Island delegate to the Democratic Convention committed to Michael Dukakis. He liked the feel of that and set his sights on the Rhode Island House of Representatives. A few months later, he threw himself into the fray like a veteran. Since no Republican was running, the Democratic primary would produce the overall winner. His opponent was the incumbent, Jack Skeffington, a veteran of the state's ward politics who, despite his good nature, was none too pleased to be going up against a youngster whom he considered no more than an upstart with a famous name who ought to be waiting his turn. Skeffington's fellow Rhode Island Democrats, an understandably close-knit group, felt the same way. And so my son found his welcome to electoral politics delivered with a bare knuckle or two. Patrick fought back with energy and good cheer. He campaigned hard and shrewdly, but fairly, against Skeffington and his supporters. Patrick argued that Skeffington had grown out of touch with the people he represented. Still underweight and a little weakened from recent surgery on a benign spinal tumor, and packing an inhalator to combat his chronic asthma, Patrick bounded about the district, practicing retail politics in his neat blue blazer and white shirt, with endless handshakes and knocks on doors. His strategy worked, reinforced somewhat by many voters' perception that Skeffington's people were coming down too hard on the young man. Patrick later admitted that he'd been anxious and nervous through much of the campaign, yet he won in September with 1,324 votes against 1,009 for his rival. He was off on a political career that 6 years later would take him to the United States House of Representatives. One incident that has become part of our family lore is the one we call the "Go Back the Way You Came" story. When Patrick first became interested in running, I took him to meet the legendary Pole, John Pastore. John was 81 then and retired from political life. He'd served Rhode Island as both governor and senator, the first Italian-American from the state to have held either office. He was a great Democrat. I remember those big, dark, soulful eyes of his, and the little mustache that he always kept trimmed. My brother Jack had thought the world of him and believed him the most electable figure in the history of Rhode Island. John had a great heart, and the people loved him. Patrick and I drove to Pastore's house one day in the early spring. It was in a neighborhood that John had never left. He was a fellow who literally never forgot where he came from. No one else was at home, so it was just the retired senator entertaining Patrick and me. John served us cookies and tea and talked politics. We were there for almost an hour, When we finally said goodbye and got back in the car, it was getting dark and we weren't sure how to get back to where we were going. Patrick got out, went back, and rang the bell. I could see him talking with Pastore, who was gesturing while Patrick nodded. Patrick came back and got back in the car but didn't say anything. I asked, "What did he say?" And Patrick, in a perfect imitation of John Pastore, barked, "Go back the way you came, Patrick. Go back the way you came." As I've noted, my son was challenging an incumbent, and within the close-knit Rhode Island Democratic establishment, it was a rarity for anyone to support a challenger. Not long after his announcement, Patrick hosted a big kickoff breakfast where lots of politicians made lots of speeches. It had gone on for quite a while, and it was time to wind it up. Half the room had emptied, and the rest were walking out. Then Patrick spotted Senator Pell. Claiborne Pell was one of the most splendid and civilized public servants I had ever been privileged to call a colleague. "He was a gentleman and a gentleman," I said at his funeral in January 2009, after he died at age 90. He counted a political lineage that stretched well back into the 19th century. He'd served on a convoy in the treacherous North Atlantic in World War II, after receiving a master's degree in history at Columbia University. Claiborne's self-effacing wit and his humane vision carried him through a 36-year Senate career, distinguished by his creation of the Pell Grants for college students in 1973, his sponsorship of legislation for the National Endowment for the Arts and the Endowment for the Humanities, and his effective support for the environmentally critical United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. I watched as Patrick walked over to Claiborne and asked him whether he would speak for just a minute. I thought, poor Claiborne. What an impossible situation for any politician. People want to go, they are going, and now he's supposed to keep their attention? I should never have worried. The movement toward the doors ceased as Claiborne moved to the podium. He gave a talk I'll never forget. It was breathtakingly short, but he hit it out of the park. In his quiet voice, he said, "We're going to end now for this morning. But before we do, I want to say why I'm here to support Patrick Kennedy. I believe that he shares the values of President Kennedy, and every night, since we've lost President Kennedy, I've knelt down on my knees and prayed that this nation would live up to the promise of John Kennedy. I believe that Patrick Kennedy will, and that's why I support him." His election victory made me feel so terribly proud of my son. After all these years, I finally understood how my dad must have felt. I had won re-election and was in Hawaii with my sisters for a vacation that spanned the 1989 New Year when the representative-elect telephoned me. He wanted me present for his inauguration. He had earlier felt that I shouldn't be there, that he should be sworn in on his own, and I had accepted his judgment. I had seen my own father step into the background for his sons, and I was certainly prepared to do the same for mine. But if my son wanted me to be there after all, I was going to come through for him. So I flew 14 hours from Honolulu to Providence for the swearing-in. I arrived at his apartment late at night. It was cold and dark, and I was exhausted. Patrick greeted me with some interesting news. He said that he was happy to see me, but his people thought it was best if I didn't go down for the swearing-in. I said, "You must be kidding." He wasn't. I didn't really mind. I was just so proud of him and so happy. Patrick thus became the second member of the emerging generation of Kennedys to gain political office. Joseph Kennedy II, Bobby's eldest son, had been elected to Congress from Massachusetts the previous year and would serve until 1999. Kathleen Townsend, Bobby's firstborn, would be elected Lieutenant Governor of Rhode Island in 1995. But Patrick became the youngest office holder of us all. Not all of the 1988 elections had gone so well. Incumbent Vice President George H.W. Bush had defeated Michael Dukakis, the governor of Massachusetts, which meant another 4 years of Republican control of the executive branch. I enjoyed a warm relationship with President Bush, and whenever the talk was about foreign policy, especially Russia, we had productive conversations. On domestic policy, however, he told me, "Relax." He had no plans for new social programs. Nevertheless, my colleagues and I were able to get some things through Congress. On July 26, 1990, President Bush signed into law the Americans with Disabilities Act, which I'd co-advocated for many years and co-sponsored with Senator Bob Dole. It brought some 43 million disabled Americans into the mainstream via special services and protections, and has been called the most sweeping civil rights act since the original back in 1964. At first, the administration had resisted our efforts. When I started discussing the legislation with John Sununu, Bush's chief of staff, he wanted to know how we were going to deal with a person in a wheelchair on a ski slope or a blind person in a bookstore. He was looking for problems and putting up a lot of roadblocks. He was always available to talk to, but progress was slow. Finally, after much negotiating, all of the important issues had been resolved. Key members attended a meeting in a Republican Senate conference room, with Dole presiding, to review everything. One last massage. Sununu was present, and once again he became obstructive and said something aggressive to a Senate aide, Bobby Silverstein. I'd had it with Sununu's bullying and slammed my hand down on the table. I told him that if he had a problem, he could deal with me. I didn't want him yelling at our staff. At one point, Sununu said that all of the staff should leave so that the principals could finish negotiating. I said, fine, then he should leave because he was staff. That seemed to quiet things down. Everyone stayed, and the rest of the meeting moved along smoothly. Around this time, I had the privilege of meeting three great men. Our conversations weren't long, but their influence on me was profound. On May 1987 at the Vatican, I was received by His Holiness, Pope John Paul II, in his private workroom. He was sitting in a hard wooden chair near a plain wooden desk. I had just visited Poland, so I told him about an extraordinary religious experience I'd had in Gdansk with Lech Wałęsa. The Pope said he'd been following Poland very closely and had been hearing many things from friends, not all of it good. He said he was concerned about the social and economic conditions, that young people might lose hope. It's not good that they don't have a real sense of their future. Wałęsa provided great symbolism, he said. That Wałęsa continued to live in Poland could be a powerful example for people. In February 1990, during a dinner at Catherine Graham's house, I met Vaclav Havel, the playwright and former dissident leader who, despite years of imprisonment and government intimidation, had led the 1989 Velvet Revolution against Czechoslovakia's communist regime. He had recently ascended to the presidency of his country and was hailed as a hero on his visit to Washington. At the dinner table, he told me that when he was in prison, he was only permitted to write for 1 hour. Every 3 months, he was permitted a new pencil. He could write one letter, which could express no philosophy or poetry. It had to be factual. When he mentioned that he hadn't been able to see much of America because he was in his car constantly, I suggested that he visit the Lincoln Memorial. To my delight, he agreed, and together we made a late-night visit to the memorial, from which I read him the inscriptions on the wall from Lincoln's second inaugural and the Gettysburg Address. He said, "I am not able to understand the language, but I understand the poetry. That same month, on February 15th, I had my first conversation with Nelson Mandela on the phone. He had been freed 4 days earlier, after 27 years of imprisonment. While in South Africa in 1985, I had gone to Soweto and visited Bishop Desmond Tutu and Mandela's wife, Winnie. Mandela told me that he knew I'd been outside his prison on that day, and that it had given his friends hope and renewed power. I invited him to visit the Kennedy Library, and 4 months later, on June 25th, he attended a lunch in his honor, where I could not help be impressed by his seriousness and honesty. He had not yet been elected president, but he expressed optimism about the integrity of South Africa's leader, F.W. de Klerk, and his intent to bring about substantive change. I asked him what he thought was the most important thing the United States could do. He said it was very simple. Jobs for the 16,000 exiled political activists who were returning to the country. Those people would need housing and job opportunities in order to be a source of stability for South Africa's future. As inspiring as these men were, it would be a woman who changed the course of my life. Part 4. Renewal. Chapter 21. The Woman Who Changed My Life. 1991. I have always believed that there are three stages of enjoying life: looking forward to something, experiencing it, and then having the memory of it. There came a point in my life when I had to admit that I'd stopped looking forward to things. There had been so much loss. I understand that everyone suffers loss. It is hardly unique to me. Yet preparing myself to savor new experiences, and especially experiences that involve new personal commitments, I faced the fact that I no longer wanted to take that risk. This is not to say I didn't enjoy life during those years. I am an enjoyer. I have always enjoyed being a senator. I've enjoyed my children and my close friends. I've enjoyed books and music and well-prepared food, especially with a generous helping of cream sauce on the top. I have enjoyed the company of women. I have enjoyed a stiff drink, or two, or three, and I've relished the smooth taste of a good wine. At times, I've enjoyed these pleasures too much. I've heard the tales about my exploits as a hellraiser, some accurate, some with a wisp of truth to them, and some so outrageous that I can't imagine how anyone could really believe them. But I never tried to correct the record. I decided long ago never to respond to tabloid gossip. Never. Once you respond to that kind of trash, you elevate it to something worth responding to. And anyway, once you begin refuting, you can never stop. Because then if you fail to deny even one such story, that might be taken as evidence that it is true. The downside here, of course, is that rumors and fictions frequently enter the public consciousness as settled fact. Still, there was enough that I was doing to cause concern to those who cared about me. My friends didn't tell me that my drinking or my private life was getting out of control, but maybe that's because we were all having too much fun at the time. Certainly, it didn't affect my Senate work. What was unspoken between me and my friends was my reason for excess. It was all part of my desire to escape, to keep moving, to avoid painful memories. And so I lived this string of years in the present tense, not despondently, because that is not my nature, but certainly with a sense of the void. All of this began to change when I rang the doorbell of the home in Northwest D.C., where I had been invited to dinner on the evening of June 17th, 1991, and found myself looking into the beautiful hazel eyes of Victoria Reggie. The occasion was a dinner party to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Vicky's parents, Judge Edmund and Doris Reggie. The Reggie and Kennedy families had been friends for many years, beginning with the judge's strong support for Jack as the vice presidential nominee in 1960. Inviting me had been the elder Reggie's idea, Vicky later told me. They'd said, "Oh, let's invite the commander," their nickname for me. Vicky and I were not strangers. Over the years, I'd seen her and her family a fair amount, usually on Nantucket where her family has a summer home, and I dined from time to time with them when the Reggies were in Washington. I was aware that Vicky and Greer Racklin had ended their 9-year marriage the previous summer. When I walked up to Vicky's door that evening, I really wasn't expecting anything other than a pleasant evening with old friends. I got quite a bit more. As Vicky ushered me into her home, she looked at me quizzically and then leaned over and looked behind me. And with a teasing half-smile on her face, my future wife sort of looked me up and down and asked, "What's wrong? Couldn't you get a date?" "I thought you'd be my date," I fired back. To which she responded, "Dream on, Kennedy." I learned later that her mother had overheard the exchange and was horrified. "Oh, Vicky, you're just never going to find a man if you talk like that." But I was enjoying the banter. Vicky was quick-witted, playful, and fun. So, all right, perhaps it wasn't love at first sight. Vicky, in fact, charges me with not even remembering her from those 70s days, when she interned in my Senate office mailroom with her long hair pressed straight down below her shoulders, a charge to which I pleaded no low contendere. But as much as Vicky and I had seen each other at various events over the years, I think that anniversary dinner party night was the first time I really saw Vicky. I helped her as she took the place setting away for the date I didn't bring, and I hung out with her in the kitchen as she prepared dinner. We shared easy conversation about issues of the day and spent a lot of the evening laughing. I hadn't felt that relaxed or lighthearted in a long time. Maybe that was what encouraged me to ask Vicky, as I left her house that night, "Well, can I call you? How about dinner tomorrow night?" Vicky said, "Sure." I've since learned that after the door closed, she went, "Did I just say yes? Have I lost my mind?" Bear in mind that this was a woman who did not exactly have to worry much about whether she would ever find a man. Vicky was then in the midst of a very fulfilling career in the law. She was a successful partner in a law firm in Washington, and she was rearing 2 young children. Her life was full and very busy. We had dinner the next night, and in the weeks following, I did everything I could think of to impress this amazing woman. I sent her bouquets of roses and fresh wildflowers. I telephoned her a lot. We went out to restaurants. We had dinner at my home. I met her friends. She met mine. And we kept up the fun banter. As strange as it now seems, we didn't discuss any of the difficult things that were going on. One night at dinner, I did make reference to a poll that showed my approval rating plummeting to 48%, and Vicky comforted me by cracking, "That's a relief, because I never go out with anyone whose approval is less than 47. I developed instant friendships with her children, Curran, who was 8 then, and Caroline, who was 5. There was no question that I'd have been good pals with these two even if I hadn't been dating their mother. Curran was seriously into sports, so I found myself following football and baseball even more closely than usual. And I spent a lot of time coloring pictures on the living room rug with Caroline, who has blossomed into a very fine painter, incidentally. At night, I would read them to sleep. One of our best adventures was trick-or-treating that first Halloween. I really enjoy Halloween with children, and used to make the neighborhood rounds with my own along with my nieces every October 31st. On this night, Vicky and I walked with Curran and Caroline through their neighborhood. We received a lot of surprised looks from Vicky's neighbors that night, but none more than at the house occupied by the cultural attaché of China. The children rang the doorbell, and a gentleman opened the door to give them candy. As he opened up, he saw me and squealed, "Oh, Kennedy!" I put out my hand to shake his and said, "How are you?" He asked us to come in and sit on the sofa. Actually, it was more like he ordered us to come in and sit on the sofa. Vicky and I looked at each other, and the children kept asking why we weren't still trick-or-treating. We could hear the gentleman who opened the door as he ran upstairs and knocked on what we assumed to be the cultural attaché's room. We heard them speaking in loud, rapid Chinese, which we could, of course, not understand except for the periodic shouting out my name, "Ted Kennedy!" This back and forth went for a few minutes. Vicky and I decided that the gentleman was trying to convince the attaché that it really was me, and the attaché was telling him that it was just some person in a Ted Kennedy mask. Eventually, we tiptoed out the door. Ironically, given that we've spent so many happy hours together at sea, our first little falling out was over a disagreement about sailing. Vicky maintains that falling out is too strong a term for it. In mid-August, I sailed Maya over from Hyannis to Nantucket to pay a visit on the Judge and Doris and, of course, Vicky, who was visiting them. I invited Vicky to sail back to Hyannisport with me. August was the beginning of the Atlantic hurricane season. The opening show, just then spiraling northeastward along the coast, was a doozy. Hurricane Bob had already bumped twice against Rhode Island, and according to news bulletins, was now heading straight for Massachusetts. On Cape Cod, its peak winds would later be clocked at 125 miles an hour. For some reason, Vicky was not terribly interested in sailing back with me.